ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning, welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 31st of October. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Buckingham Palace has announced Prince Andrew will lose his titles and be forced to move out of Royal Lodge over his ties to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The King's younger brother will now be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer is in London. He joined me a short time ago. Elias, who's made this decision?
Well, according to Buckingham Palace, it's the King. So in a statement issued by the palace, it says His Majesty has begun a process to remove the title, style and honours of Prince Andrew, meaning he'll now be referred to as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Now, this is an extraordinary development, really, because there'd been intensifying pressure around the royal family to make a decision on this. One, his titles, but also his residence at the Royal Lodge, that 30-bedroom manor set out on Great Windsor Park. And it appears the King has affected decisions on both of these matters. So Andrew Mountbatten Windsor will move to Sandringham, and he no longer has his titles, which, according to many reports, mean a lot to him.
Where will he live now?
So he'll be at Sandringham, which is a property owned privately by the King, so it's not a part of the broader Crown estate. Now, there'd been a lot of negotiations around this, reportedly. Initially, it had been stated that Andrew had been digging his heels in. He didn't want to leave the Royal Lodge, a property he's been living in for about 24 years now and, of course, doesn't pay any rent on. It was reported that he wanted two homes in exchange for moving out, including one for his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson. Then it was reported that he wanted to have a property closer to London to be closer to his daughters. But none of that has come to fruition. So he'll be in Sandringham, and the palace says that further details around the location and which property it is will be released at a later date.
Now, this all comes after mounting pressure on the palace to act after years of scandal. Can you remind us about how we got to this point?
Prince Andrew had long been a, I guess, derided figure, and that had really been the scenario or the case since about 2010, when it was revealed that he'd had dealings with Jeffrey Epstein, who at that stage had been convicted of soliciting prostitution with a minor. Now, later, when he gave that ill-fated interview with Emily Maitlis, he had said that he was there to break off contact with him, but the, I guess, accusations and the questions surrounding that relationship just continued to grow and build. And it appeared as if Andrew Mountbatten Windsor hadn't exactly been transparent about that particular relationship. Then, of course, there's the allegations from the late Virginia Giuffre, who took her own life earlier this year. She claims that Jeffrey Epstein and convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell had forced her to have sex with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor three times. Now, Andrew has repeatedly denied this, but he did pay a settlement in the realm of about $22 million to the late Virginia Giuffre. So this had all been the atmosphere surrounding Andrew, and it's just gotten to a point where I think it's untenable for the royal family, and they've decided to act and act swiftly, as we've seen.
Elias Kluwer there in London. Victoria has become the first state to pass legislation enabling a treaty with Indigenous people. The bill passed the state's parliament last night, leading to emotional scenes in the public gallery. Once signed, the treaty will make permanent a representative body called the First Peoples Assembly and give Indigenous people in the state more say over government decisions that impact their lives. Oliver Gordon reports.
Late night cheers as Victoria's upper house passes treaty legislation with its First Peoples.
To finally see it actually occur there on the floor of Parliament was just unbelievable.
Reuben Berg is co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria.
A treaty is an agreement, and in this case, it's an agreement between the First Peoples of Victoria and the state government of Victoria. And essentially, this treaty is about resetting the relationship between those two communities.
The landmark vote gives elected Aboriginal people the power to make rules on matters that directly affect them through a new authority, the Galang Wal.
So the bill creates the Galang Wal, which is this new treaty landscape. And within that will sit some key treaty bodies. And that will enable First Peoples to have a much better say on the things that affect them, and also be able to make decisions about things that directly affect First Peoples.
Like what?
One of the key areas of decision-making is around the confirmation of Aboriginality process to ensure that First Peoples are determining what that process should be looking like. Also, the ability to appoint experts into various areas of government to make sure that our expertise is being heard the right way.
The authority also includes bodies that will continue the truth-telling work of the Yuruk Justice Commission and a First Peoples-led group that will monitor what the state government is doing to close the gap between Indigenous Victorians and non-Indigenous Victorians when it comes to health, education and economic outcomes. Reuben Berg again.
It's been demonstrated again and again that when you have the people who are most directly affected by a matter being able to make decisions about it, particularly at local levels and at regional levels, you do see better outcomes. And this new bill, which is the result of the treaty, enables that to happen across Victoria.
What would you say to people who are comparing what's happened here to the effort for the Voice to Parliament at a federal level?
The treaty-making process we've been on here in Victoria is very, very different from the referendum that happened a couple of years ago. That was about a national issue, and this is about a state issue. That was about changing the constitution, and there's no constitutional change here. And essentially, that was a model that was not as tried and true and tested. Whereas here in Victoria, we're implementing something that's already been in existence for the First Peoples Assembly for the last 6 years and has demonstrated success.
This month, the state opposition confirmed it would scrap the treaty agreement if elected at next year's Victorian state election. Opposition leader Brad Batten telling reporters earlier this month a Liberal government would instead create an advisory body called First Nations Victoria.
Our sole goal is to close the gap when it comes to Indigenous people across Australia. We don't believe the treaty is the pathway to that.
The bill will be signed by the Victorian government and First Peoples Assembly in coming weeks. Then there'll be a ceremonial event in December.
Oliver Gordon reporting. Senators from across the political divide have teamed up to put pressure on the government to release a long-awaited secret report. Sparks flew in the Senate as the non-Labor senators argued against what they call a lack of government transparency and repeated refusals to release the report into board appointments. It led to the longest continuous question time on record. Political reporter Adam Langenberg has the story.
Thursdays in the Senate aren't always considered must-watch viewing. But yesterday, sparks were flying. The government pitted against the crossbench and the opposition.
They're yelling at a woman trying to ask a question about women's health.
Senator Watt?
I think this is a really landmark question time.
You might not like the orders of the Senate, but you have to comply with them.
Question time stretched for 3.5 hours, the longest continuous one on record, with government anger bubbling over as Labor backbenchers like Marielle Smith were repeatedly blocked from asking questions.
We have a democratic right to represent our constituents as well. I have a right to ask questions.
Coalition Senator Anne Rustin claims the government has threatened retribution by potentially removing Liberals and Nationals from deputy chair positions on parliamentary committees, roles that come with a pay rise.
They should not be allowed to be bullying people in this place.
The cause of the uproar, the Coalition, Greens and the crossbench agreeing to a motion from Independent Senator David Pocock to extend question time by 5 non-government questions until a report into government board appointments is released.
This is a report that we were told would lead to a change in culture in Canberra when it comes to jobs for mates. That was promised 2 years ago. We've had a government sitting on that report.
Employment Minister Katie Gallagher says the report is still being considered by Cabinet and will be released once the government's position has been finalised. But Senator Pocock says that argument doesn't stack up.
A document that goes to Cabinet, that cannot in any way really reveal the actual deliberations on that document.
Gabrielle Appleby, the research director at the Centre for Public Integrity, says the delay in releasing the report speaks to a bigger issue.
There has been a very concerning trend in relation to this government, in relation to transparency and its approach to welcoming accountability and questioning of its actions.
Professor Appleby says that's illustrated by how often the government refuses freedom of information requests and fails to hand over the documents it's ordered to by the Senate. The Centre has even ranked Anthony Albanese's government the second least transparent in the last 30 years.
We can also see it structurally. The government introduced the Freedom of Information Amendment Bill, which is a regressive reform that winds back the public's right to access information.
Professor Gabrielle Appleby from the Centre for Public Integrity, ending that report by Adam Langenberg. Hundreds of thousands of Israel's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community have shut down one of Jerusalem's busiest junctions in a show of force against plans to make them serve in the nation's military. Last year, Israel's Supreme Court ruled sweeping exemptions for the conservative religious community from conscription were illegal. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
This is where Highway 1 from Tel Aviv arrives in the heart of Jerusalem city centre. But instead of being choked with traffic, huge crowds, predominantly men in their traditional black and white attire, are converging. Yonatan Akashi is among them with a clear message.
We are come here to say to the world and to the government, we are not scared for anybody, we are not scared for anyone. We're here for to fight.
It's as much a message to the broader Israeli community as it is to politicians, as sentiment towards the ultra-Orthodox sours. This draft issue has been a thorn in the side of the Netanyahu government ever since Israel's Supreme Court handed down its landmark ruling that the Haredi community, as they're called in Hebrew, can't use a commitment to study the Jewish religious text, the Torah, as a means to escape conscription. The Prime Minister's coalition, which includes religious parties, has been divided on the issue. Some want the exemptions restored, some want the Orthodox forced into service, and others have been trying to strike a compromise, ultimately annoying everyone else in the process. Levi Grossman served in the military before becoming religious.
People have to choose if they would like to go to army or they have to get to study Torah. If they decide to study Torah, so the ministry and everybody have to support them and not to try to throw them into jail.
The IDF believes there are around 80,000 ultra-Orthodox men aged between 18 and 24 who are eligible to enlist. Various ideas have been floated to convince the Haredi to join, from banning people of national service age from leaving the country to blocking them getting driver's licences and revoking access to childcare subsidies. In the meantime, tens of thousands of draft notices have been sent out, and some have been arrested by military police for failing to comply. 19-year-old Yosef Cohen has been served with such an order.
I received a call-up notice. I also received an arrest warrant. That means I can be arrested at any given moment. I'm 19 years old. I took it and I tore it up.
The day before the protest, Israeli media reported a new draft bill was ready, tweaking some of the penalties for draft dodging and loopholes to avoid national service. One leading Israeli opposition politician, Yair Lapid, said it was a disgrace and spat in the face of combat soldiers. Days earlier, he'd suggested the idea of stripping voting rights from people who did not enlist in the military. This is an issue unique to Israel, and it will require a similarly unique political fix. But this crowd is making it clear it won't be yielding to demands to fight without putting up its own fight first. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Californians are currently voting on a proposal to redraw their state's congressional districts to notionally give more of an advantage to Democrats in next year's US midterm elections. It's a tit-for-tat move proposed by the state's governor, Gavin Newsom. However, experts and onlookers worry about what the entire saga is doing to America's democracy. The ABC's chief elections analyst, Casey Briggs, has the story.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is taking the fight up to Donald Trump.
We're fighting fire with fire. We're not fighting with one hand tied behind our back.
He's campaigning for a proposal to suspend the congressional district maps that were drawn by California's Independent Commission and replace them with manipulated district boundary maps, also known as gerrymandered maps, designed to hand Democrats more seats. Recent polls give the proposition a very good chance of passing. To Australian ears, it sounds ridiculous. A partisan grab for power that wouldn't be allowed here. But this is actually the return shot, aiming to neutralise Republicans who did much the same thing in Texas earlier this year. President Donald Trump made no secret of his motivation, telling CNBC in August that
we have an opportunity in Texas to pick up 5 seats. We have a really good governor and we have good people in Texas. We are entitled to 5 more seats.
Professor Richard Hassan from the University of California says this tit-for-tat gerrymandering is being seen as crucial to determining who controls Congress after the midterm elections next year.
This is 100% driven by Donald Trump's attempt to try to fight against what many people see as inevitable, which is Republicans losing control of the House of Representatives. And it really is a race to the bottom.
And it appears to have escalated into an arms race. The Republican-controlled states of Missouri and North Carolina have changed their districts. Mr. Trump is encouraging other states, and Democratic governors are considering their options. Gerrymandering to seek partisan advantage isn't popular among voters, but it's perfectly legal. Richard Hassan again.
At the very least, it undermines people's confidence that the rules are fair. Everybody's being accused of rigging the election or cheating. I mean, the language is very heated.
Professor Grant Reher from Syracuse University agrees.
The big question is, where does it stop? And so if we're going to do it for 2026, are we going to do it again for 2028 and for 2030? If the American way of doing this is a problem, then you're just putting it on steroids by doing it over and over again.
It makes political sense for the Democrats, who are confronted with what they see as a real and illegitimate threat that they'll be shut out of power. But Professor Reher questions whether it's good for democracy in the long term.
If this is explicitly undemocratic, then is leaning into that somehow okay because the other side is doing it?
Voting in California ends on Wednesday, Australian time.
Casey Briggs. Some of Australia's leading athletes plan to form a players' coalition to use their influence to lobby politicians for reform on socio-political issues. Amanda Shalala reports.
What a magical moment for Usman Khawaja.
People say sport and politics don't mix. I've seen politicians all over cricket my whole life.
Cricketer Usman Khawaja is one of the highest profile Australian athletes who regularly wades into political issues. On the ABC TV series Endgame, which explores racism in sport, he's agreed to link up with other athletes and form a players' coalition.
Nothing in Australia will happen unless you have connections to those politicians. I think something like that could be really great.
This is a moment to savour.
The first African-born woman to play in the AFLW, Akech Makur Chot, now retired, has also joined the group.
We'll be able to have a collective voice as a coalition, as the players, and put forward what changes we need to make our workplace safe for us. So then we are able to, you know, be empowered, because a lot of us are not empowered at the moment.
The idea is modelled on the Players Coalition in the US, which has over 1,500 athletes, coaches and owners across 10 professional leagues.
It is caught by Anquan Boldin for the touchdown.
It was co-founded by former NFL player Anquan Boldin.
There's a wide variety of issues that the Players Coalition has tackled. Anything from mandatory minimum sentencing to gun laws, voting rights, putting money back into the school system, homelessness.
And Boldin says the group has seen the results, with around 30 pieces of legislation changed since its inception 7 years ago.
We had one organization that had been working on an issue for, I think it was 5 years. They wanted to get an audience before Congress. Well, we paired two athletes with this organization to get behind the same issue. And in 3 months, they had a hearing before Congress.
Winter Olympian and now independent MP Zali Steggall knows the pulling power of athletes.
High-profile sports people have an opportunity to shine a light on an issue and to open doors that others may not have.
Makul Chort has experienced racist abuse online and says one of the group's first missions will be encouraging major sports to lobby the social media companies.
You're telling me that you don't, as a big organisation like the AFL, you don't have that power to be able to work with an organisation like Meta to make it a safe place for your players.
AFLW player Akechma Kuachuot, ending that report by Amanda Shalala. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Home invasions, stabbings, carjackings. In Victoria, there's been a wave of serious and violent crimes. But is it right to label Melbourne the crime capital of Australia? Today, ABC Melbourne Mornings presenter Raphael Epstein. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.